Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Not surprisingly, the Memorandum of Understanding ending the U.S.-Israel war on Iran means different things to different people. Since the signing, the Trump administration has actively attempted to renegotiate the deal in real time. Those attempts haven't opened the Strait of Hormuz. Crosstalking Deadlock, I'm joined by my guest, Daniel McAdams in Lake Jackson. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. In Tucson, we have Leila Hudson. She is a professor of global studies at the University of Arizona. And in Malaysia, we have Julia Rocknifard. She is a senior lecturer at Taylor's University. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, let me go to you first here. It seems to me we have this really, really chronic case of buyer's remorse, because Donald Trump signed something on the 17th, and it seems to me in retrospect, and I'm not going to go through the what's happened in the last 24 hours or the last 36 hours, because, you know, folks, I really don't know what's happened. I don't know who to believe, who's going where, who's meeting what and talking about what. It's very, very confused. That may be by design. But, Daniel, this is buyer's remorse. All Trump wants is the Strait of Hormuz open. He's not really particularly interested in anything else.
No, I mean, it's sort of like a heroin addict. He keeps taking those shots, but they're not doing the same thing. You know, he's manipulating the markets. He went through, I think, 40 times someone counted that the deal is almost there. It's almost there. Friday afternoon, you do the bombs, and Sunday afternoon, you say, we're going to talk next week, over and over and over again, and it's not working. And so at this point, when the market wasn't responding the way he was hoping it would, he had to finally do a deal. But it wasn't a deal like you do in diplomacy. It was a deal like you do in the real estate market in New York City, I suppose, where you sign on the line, and then after it's done, you completely renegotiate. No, it didn't say that. It doesn't say you get doors in your flat. It doesn't say you get a bathroom. You know, all of these things that in fact it does say, and that's what's happening right now. The Iranians once again felt that they were in good faith negotiations with the U.S., and again, they've been proven wrong, which is one of the reasons why the Iranian side is hardening. We saw this letter from the Council on of Experts that's come out, and I guess we'll talk about it later as well, but they're fed up with this as well. So this is not how you do a diplomacy.
Yeah, Leila, it seems to me this memorandum of understanding is, by at least from the point of view of Tehran, is a masterclass for the Americans to learn how to do diplomacy again. Because I agree, when you look at the 14 points, there is ambiguity, and that's good because it gets you talking, okay? But you can't say, oh, but the unfrozen assets will be used to buy American goods, when no one in Tehran even, they were probably surprised by that as well. I mean, the way the memorandum of understanding is structured is that this is a process to get to the end of the conflict. And as I said in my first question to Daniel, Trump just wants the Strait open. He doesn't want to do anything else. Go ahead.
Right. Well, it seems to me you could think of it as a memorandum of misunderstanding.
Yep.
And that's actually a comfortable and familiar place for many of the various parties to be in a state of tension, confusion, misunderstanding, and buying time over various real and perceived renegotiations of the 14 points. It seems to me it buys time and it initiates a phase of back and forth, renegotiation. And if that's the way the Americans need to learn diplomacy, so be it.
Yeah, but it gets very, very frustrating because everyone's talking about time. Julia, I mean, the Iranians have more time. I mean, what is the famous question? Who's got the clocks and who's got the time? Okay, maybe Trump has the clock, but it's better to have the time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. Iranians are the ones who have the time, and by all the thinkable and unthinkable estimates, Iran is the one who ended up in a stronger position by discovering this gift of the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Probably Iranians themselves did not expect this to bring them such results, where it's finding itself in the position of this rising hegemon in the region. For Iranians, there could be two ways. One is to continue just fending off these attacks, which some call skirmishes, which I'm sure are going to flare up from time to time. Or Iran could decide, if some of the red lines are crossed, Iran could decide to resume the military action. But here it tries to hold the high moral ground, also trying to look conciliatorily, while it strategically it would be still more prudent for Iran to bring the action to the victorious end, and if not to kick out the U.S. forces from the region, then at least to make a point to keep them at some very, very reasonable distance.
Yeah, or said differently, they want to keep their winnings, okay? And this is what the Trump people are trying to whittle away every single day by bringing up the really ridiculous things about assets, frozen assets and whatnot. It looks like some assets have been released, but not by the Americans. It's by some of the Gulf monarchies are doing that. Daniel, to add to the mix here, we have this kind of really weird tango with Vice President Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. I mean, are they working at cross purposes, or is this just simply incompetence? I mean, please explain it.
Yeah, I wish I could do that, Peter, but I can't. I don't understand what's happening. I don't understand what's happened to the State Department. I don't understand where the experts are. I mean, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner are apparently going back to the Middle East. There's no one to negotiate with. I mean, I don't understand why the Iranians would negotiate with them in the first place, as it was with negotiations with the two of them twice that their country was bombed. And the other thing is that Witkoff has shown himself to be absolutely incompetent when it comes to the technical aspects of the nuclear of the nuclear question. He almost triggered the war when he came back in February and said some things that actually weren't true. He had to be corrected by the Qataris, the intermediaries, because he said some things that were not true, which made it appear as if the Iranians were laughing at us. Of course, understanding what that would do to his boss. I guess it's not his boss because he doesn't have a position in the government. He's just some real estate guy who's hanging out and going over to these places, probably making a few deals on the side. But that's a long way of saying, Peter, I don't understand what's happening. I don't understand the role of J.D. Vance in this. I don't understand the role of Marco Rubio. None of it makes any sense. As someone who's been, you know, following U.S. diplomacy since the Reagan era, I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, Layla, but it is quite obvious, irrespective of what the dynamic is of these surrounding these two gentlemen. Israel is showing itself to be a wedge in all of this, and this is a part of Israeli statecraft, and the Americans seem hopeless in dealing with it.
Well, it's interesting. Again, if you think of it as a hedging strategy, what you're seeing is amongst the potential successors to Donald Trump, whose yep. health is increasingly in question every single day, you see the hedging of the different possibilities, with J.D. Vance spearheading the MOU, Memorandum of Understanding or Misunderstanding, as people asked, where is the Department of State in all this? And lo and behold, if memory serves, Marco Rubio showed up at the signing of the Lebanese-Israeli separate agreement, which clearly undermined, if not actually sabotaged, the Memorandum of Misunderstanding. So if you look at it from the perspective of J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio's boss, you're playing both sides. You are hedging, you are prolonging the state of limbo, which, as we noted before, time is on Iran's side. And yet that same time of kicking the can down the road is a comfortable place that American diplomacy has been accustomed to being in, endless processes, endless negotiations, which themselves constitute something between war and peace and diplomacy. So again, where was Marco Rubio on the MOU? Nowhere in sight.
Nowhere in sight.
He's there on the signing of the very compromising treaty between what you might think of as Vichy Lebanon and Israel.
Yep. Well, I like that. I'm going to use that in the future. I like that a lot. Vichy Lebanon. Julia, I mean, you're in Malaysia. I mean, there's talk of how some ships are leaving the going through the Strait of Hormuz, but very few people want to talk about there are no ships going in to pick up oil. So this illusion of the oil price being stabilized is not really there. If no one's going there to pick up oil, then we're going to see this spiral of the oil price again, and very, very soon. Julia.
Yeah, there is such a possibility. And there are many effects of this disruption caused by the blockade, which already has been said it's even more grave than the 1973 disruption. Yep. After the Yom Kippur War. And these disruptions concern not only oil and gas supplies, which we are going to feel the effects for a long time, and the experts are already saying that the prices also will not stabilize for months and months to come. There are also other factors which are affecting oil and gas market. Besides, there are other products, like, for example, I don't think we've felt effect of lack of fertilizer supplies yet, because the crops were not planted. So that's something that we are going to see only next year, probably, when we will not have that food on our tables or in our fridges to get it out and to cook. So the disruptive effect, I think, still remains to be seen of what's going to happen. Malaysia did a little bit better than its neighbors in ASEAN because, well, Malaysia is an oil exporter, but the Philippines, Indonesia, they faced quite an undersupply of fuel, and many people were even forced to work from home.
Yeah, and there's no reason to believe that it's going to get any better. On that note, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on deadlock. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing deadlock. Okay, let's go back to Daniel in Lake Jackson. You said it in the very first part of the program, this Council of Experts in Iran, warning the negotiators not to deviate from what the Supreme Leader has agreed to. And we all know that the Supreme Leader was not overwhelmed with the 14 points, but he said, go with it. And now it's being made clear that compromise is not going to be part of their vocabulary. They have the cards, they have their winnings on the table, and they're going to proceed, because they have won this conflict. They have won a strategic victory. Military victory, you can discuss that in another way, but a strategic one. And that's their hardening position here. Do you think the Trump administration realizes this?
I don't know that they do. I mean, there certainly are some people, there must be some people in the Pentagon or the State Department that are actually doing some thinking about it and understand what's happened. But, you know, the interesting thing is, I mean, this will go down in history, of course. This war will go down in history as not only the most unpopular war in American history. It started underwater, and it has continued. I think it just surpassed the Vietnam War as being the most unpopular war at its conclusion, if it is at its conclusion in history. But interestingly enough, the JCPOA that President Trump got out of in 2018, I think that's going to start being reexamined as well, because the JCPOA essentially was putting Iran in a bottle. And all of us look back fondly on it because it looked like a relieving of tension. It looked like one of President Obama's few foreign policy successes. But essentially what it did is it put Iran in a bottle and prevented it from breaking out as a regional hegemon, which this war has done. Yep. So in essence, by starting this war on a whim or on the sweet whispers of Bibi Netanyahu, President Trump has actually not only undermined the JCPOA, but actually released Iran from its position of as a sleeping giant in the region. Yep. To the point where it, in the parlance of the administration, it indeed holds all the cards in the region. And whenever there is a skirmish, actually a couple of weeks later, we find out that the Iranians, when they hit back, they hit something very important and they hit it very precisely. And that is something that I think is certainly they're paying attention to in the Pentagon.
Yeah, Leila, it looks like it'll be very difficult for the Trump administration and Israel to return to what they call kinetic action here. I mean, looking at open source information, a lot of material, American war material, is being removed from the region. Meanwhile, because the Americans just seem to be incapable of honest negotiations, Iran is talking to the Russians, the Chinese, to the Gulf monarchies. There's some Europeans, you know, doing a little pillow talk, saying we can make a deal one-on-one. I mean, while the Americans dither, the Iranians are going down the path of diplomacy full blast.
Sure. Well, you know, as we look at this situation of settlement, stalemate, deadlock, and perhaps the initiation of a period of ritualistic conflict. And we hope, in fact, that that is what the kinetic part is actually evolving into, that, you know, every now and then there will be an incident, an episode, everyone will recalibrate and assess what the other side is actually communicating. And the most positive view of this, frankly, is that this is a slow unwinding of the American hegemonic position in the Middle East. And if it can take this contained form of stalemate, low intensity conflict, ritualized back and forth, it gives the various parties time to settle matters within their own administration or regime, whether that's on the Iranian side, as we go between the IRGC and some of the residual non-IRGC leadership, or whether it's between different factions of the Trump administration and the other players in the American scene. The other thing, though, that happens during this period is that vascularization, if you will, of multilateral contacts, trade routes, bilateral agreements, infrastructure projects, yep, with various parties, so that, again, anyone who was under the impression right up through February of 2026 that their security was assured simply by being in the shadow of a particular hegemon or another understands that it's actually very good to be talking to multiple potential partners, including those with whom one has had historical disagreements, conflicts, bitter mortal feuds, in fact, as I think many of the regional and global players see the outline of a potential multilateralized region, vascularized, if you will, with pipelines and highways and trade routes and new forms of commerce and diplomacy. That is the rosiest view that one can take of what is unfolding here, an orderly unwinding, perhaps, of the American hegemonic presence.
My shorthand is the end of Sykes-Picot, but I get you absolutely. Julia, one of the things that's very interesting is that there's a wide recognition, maybe the Americans publicly don't want to admit it, certainly the Israelis, but there's no going back to the status quo ante. Iran has just had a jail break, and they're not going back to jail.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it has been proven in the course of this latest so-called skirmishes when Iran attacked the tanker going through the Omani route, the route of the coast of Oman, signaling that it's not what was agreed. And even though it's not a part of the memorandum of understanding, the understanding, the spirit behind it, was that Iran is going to control what goes in and out, and it considered itself entitled to attack somebody who was breaking this law. So now, every now and then, probably, Iran could lean on this threat of blocking the Strait of Hormuz. And what we discussed with the colleagues just now, that what Leila said about vascularization as a sign of multipolarity or multiplex world, the nascent one, that just triggered these kind of processes among the Persian Gulf states. And they are starting to talk even with Iran, understanding, yes, that there is no bypassing Iran in forging, and there is a need to forge this new security architecture. And that's probably for the best, to be friends with Iran. Yeah. Also not sign the Abraham Accords, something that Trump in the 90th minute tried to squeeze out of them, but no such thing is happening. And I think the public in those states would be also vehemently against such a move. So Iran, although a lot criticized a lot with the protests of the past years, with a lot of criticism over the human rights situation and whatnot, it stands firm. It's got enough supplies. It's got enough military supplies to even resume the conflict. And it can finally bring the parties to the table. Maybe for somebody it will be unwillingly, but still to bring them to the table in order to talk through what's going to happen in the region.
Yeah, because the Americans can't protect you. They've proven it, okay? Daniel, how is this playing out in American politics, particularly with the midterms coming up? I mean, you know, watching Fox News and other mainstream media, when I watch it, I think, what war are they talking about? I have no idea. Completely divorced from reality. I mean, it is really, really remarkable how they're spinning this, okay? Again, just a parallel universe. Can Trump survive this? What's the impact?
Well, I appreciate my colleague's visual with the you know, the sort of the expanding trade routes, you know, this the extending, because there's one country in the region that cannot bear that, and that's Israel. Mm-hmm. And I'll get back to the U.S. because it will lead to the U.S., but they can't stand this expanding routes of exchange of commerce, and they've emerged as the biggest loser. I mean, they're still doing a heck of a job of killing civilians. That seems to be what they do best. But in the longer term, the end of U.S. hegemony in the Middle East is the end of Israel in the Middle East, and I think Israel understands that. And that's why we're seeing things like the Section 224 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which essentially combines, for lack of a better term, the U.S. and the Israeli military. I mean, the intelligence sharing, the sharing of, unbelievably sensitive material, the coordination of Israeli goals in the region with U.S. goals in the region, and the inability of a president. Essentially, the inability of a future president, tying a future president's hand in terms of foreign policy, which is unconstitutional. This is a last-ditch effort by Israel and Israel supporters in the United States to salvage something out of what has become an absolute nightmare for Israel in the region. It's not obvious yet. But one of the things that we are seeing is the Israel lobby in the U.S. showing its teeth and showing its claws. And they haven't done that before. They haven't intervened so obviously in U.S. elections in the past. But now with the overturn, with the loss of Thomas Massey, we can see very, very clearly what they are willing to do to maintain their control on Washington and on Congress. And that's what we're seeing now. So we're seeing a lot of Israeli money going into these midterms, desperate to keep their hold on Congress, which really is their last foothold, for their own survival. So that is, I think, the biggest loss is the Israeli loss, and it's something that's not happening now. But you can see the writing on the wall. You know, we see the polls.
What happened in New York last week?
Yes, exactly. And there'll be more and more of that as we move along. Young people, young candidates who are not, you know, beholden to the old shibboleths of the past, and they certainly understand that the pulse of the nation beyond the Fox News and all of the propaganda.
Well, I guess we're ending on a semi-optimistic note. Of course, you know, we wouldn't be having this kind of conversation 2 years ago, and that's what this change of perception is really, truly remarkable. But will it make a difference? Well, we'll all get back together and talk about it. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Lake Jackson, Tucson, and in Malaysia. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.